Welcome to this special presentation of the unabridged audiobook of Afterlife, A Rainy Day Investigation, on the Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs fiction podcast. Afterlife was inspired by a real-life investigation conducted by co-author and parapsychologist Lloyd Auerbach that was the case that made him believe in ghosts. Although Afterlife is book two in the series, you can enjoy it as a standalone story. However, you'll likely also want to listen to Near Death, the novel that introduces Dr. Jennifer Day, anthropology professor and parapsychologist, to her skeptical partner, former police detective Nate Rainey. In Afterlife, Danny, a young boy, makes friends with the ghost of a woman, Maureen, who used to live in the house his family has moved into. He's the only one who can see and hear her. Maureen died 15 years earlier, trying to make her escape from a botched bank robbery, at which time she hid millions of dollars in cash and valuables. Unfortunately, she can't remember where. But that's not going to stop her old partners from doing everything they can to find their long-lost treasure, no matter what the cost. If you enjoyed this free presentation, I hope you'll take a minute to post a review on Amazon, Audible, and Goodreads, as well as your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to listen to Near Death, along with my weekly short stories, here on Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs. And now, Part 15 of Afterlife, A Rainy Day Investigation, by Rich Hosick, Arnold Rundick, and Lloyd Auerbach. Chapter 56. The officer who had gone to investigate the car hidden in the woods returned with an envelope with some pink and white pages sticking out of one end. "It's a rental," he reported, handing the documents in his gloved hand to the chief. Chief Lewis pulled the papers out by a corner and spread them out on the roof of his car.
"Looks like someone from out of state."
"Or using a false identity," Nate suggested.
"Yeah, probably," Lewis agreed.
He addressed his men.
"All right, let's grab the gear and head out."
He turned to Nate, Jennifer, and Sam.
"Wait here."
"What? No way," Jennifer said. "We're going with you."
"I can help," Sam insisted.
"This is as far as I'm willing to take civilians. I can't be responsible for you."
"You don't have to be," Jennifer said. She turned to Nate.
"Can he keep us from going?"
Nate answered plainly. "Nope, this is public land." He wasn't sure that was exactly true, but he wanted to give Lewis an excuse to back down. The chief looked at Nate.
"If you get lost, you're on your own."
"Fair enough," Nate agreed.
"Let's go."
The chief led the way. After a short time, they picked up the path that Danny and his kidnapper had trampled down and met up with the trail that hugged the side of the mountain. They arrived at the entrance to the mine. Someone had obviously torn away some of the overgrowth and discovered the cement plug. One of the officers shined his light on it.
"Doesn't look like anyone's trying to get in this way," he reported.
"Okay, so much for that theory,"
Lewis said, casting an annoyed look in the direction of Nate and Sam.
"There's another way in," Sam said.
"And you know this how?"
Chief Lewis asked. Sam raised his eyebrows as if to say, "How do you think?"
"Did our ghost happen to tell you where this other entrance is?"
"That part is kind of fuzzy, just that they had to squeeze in."
Nate shrugged. "Assuming that car does belong to the kidnapper, where else would they have gone?" Lewis turned to the older officer, McDonald.
"Head back to the cars, just in case they somehow double back another way."
Liam tipped his hat in a casual salute.
"You got it, chief."
"You two start knocking that out,"
the chief said to his other officers, indicating the cement plug. Then he turned to Nate.
"We'll split up and look for another way in. I'll take Psychic Sam this way. You take the doc that way."
Nate looked up the trail in the direction the chief had pointed. It disappeared around an outcropping of rock jutting out of the mountain like a fin. The chief tapped one of the officers hefting a pickaxe on his shoulder.
"Give him your radio."
The officer handed the device to Nate, who made sure it was turned on and caused the chief's radio to squelch when he pressed the transmit button. He clipped it to his belt.
"If you find anything, radio it in. It's going to be dusk soon. It'll get dark quickly."
Nate nodded, then stepped aside as Sam left Jennifer's side to join the chief. He noticed a look pass between the two of them, one of concern for each other, solidifying in his mind that there was something more than a professional relationship between them. "Come on," he said to Jennifer. "I guess we're looking for a small hole and a big mountain." The two younger officers started pounding away at the cement as Nate and Jennifer started down the path, scanning the rock face up and down,
looking for any sign of another entrance to the mine. They rounded the outcropping and discovered a barrier of trees and shrubs between them and the rock face. Nate glanced down at Jennifer's feet and saw her ever-present Vans. I knew I should have put on my hiking boots. Jennifer smiled teasingly.
You really should stop dressing like a cop.
I dress like a grown man.
Well, you do look good in a suit, she said to him with a wink. I'll crawl around in the weeds. I'm smaller anyway.
She tightened her ponytail and looked for a way past the first group of trees.
It shouldn't be too hard to get to if it's there. See if there's any broken branches around, or marks in the dirt.
Nothing so far, she reported.
Nate watched her through the thick foliage as she examined the stone for any cracks large enough for a person. It was really starting to get dark, and even darker still among the trees. Jennifer pulled out her phone and put it in flashlight mode to aid her search.
Nate had a strange feeling. There was something wrong, but he couldn't put his finger on what it was.
Probably Sam's presence, coupled with Jennifer's casual flirtation.
And what did she mean he looked good in a suit?
He stopped that train of thought and returned his attention to the task at hand. Jennifer Day was a mystery he wasn't likely to unravel anytime soon, nor was he sure that he wanted to. Nate turned on his own phone's flashlight and scanned the area around the trail, looking for any sign that someone had been there ahead of them. It was too dry and hard to hold footprints, but perhaps Danny had the presence of mind to leave a clue. Then he saw it, tucked under a bush, a small hiker's backpack. Jennifer, he called out without taking his eyes off the pack, fearful that if he looked away, he would lose it. Jennifer rustled through the bushes until she emerged next to Nate.
What is it?
Nate pointed at the pack. Do you see that? Jennifer swung the light from her phone in the direction of his finger. It was clearly a backpack. They advanced, and Nate was careful not to touch it as he moved the branches away. It wasn't dirty or wet, so it likely hadn't been there long. He carefully lifted the flap and looked inside. There were snacks and bottles of water. Jennifer used her light to scan the rock behind the bushes where the pack was hidden. She found a dark triangle at the foot of a slight crevice.
I think we found it, she said.
Nate looked over at the spot Jennifer was illuminating. He added his own light, and it was obvious that there was more than just a depression in the rock, and there were clear scrape marks on the ground where someone had squeezed themselves inside. Danny likely wouldn't have had much trouble, but anyone Nate's size would not make it without widening the hole. I'll call the chief, he said, reaching for the radio clip to his belt.
I think I can get in, Jennifer said.
Hang on, Nate said.
He clicked the transmit button on the radio and spoke into the device.
Chief Lewis, this is Rainey. Come in, over.
He released the button and listened. Nothing.
He tried again. Chief Lewis, this is Nate Rainey. I think we have the back door. Come in, over.
Still, nothing.
Anyone, come in, over.
This time, there was the hint of a voice amid a cloud of static.
Can anyone hear me? Over.
More static.
We better go back, Nate said, noticing that the sky was already purple from the sunset. Total darkness was not far behind.
Are you kidding? Jennifer asked. What if they sneak out while we're gone?
Okay, you go and let them know we found another way in. I'll stay here and keep a lookout.
Jennifer didn't seem satisfied with this suggestion.
No,
she said resolutely.
What do you mean, no? Nate asked.
We're responsible. If we hadn't taken on this case...
No, this whole treasure hunt thing has been going on for a decade and a half. If they hadn't called us, they would have called someone else.
I'm going in, Jennifer said.
That's not a good idea.
Jennifer ignored him and dropped close to the ground so she could get a better view of the entrance.
There's a 10-year-old boy in there, scared, tired, cold.
They could be armed.
Jennifer looked back at Nate, a challenging look on her face.
If you thought you could fit through that hole, you'd be inside already.
She had him there.
Be careful, he said. Jennifer nodded, then scurried into the opening. She made it through, though not easily, reaffirming to Nate that if she needed him, there was no way he would be able to follow. Chapter 57. Dale shone his flashlight up at the ceiling of the mine, searching for the air vent Maureen had mentioned, if she actually had. How could he be sure they were her words, and not something the boy was making up? Regardless, he had no choice. There was nowhere else the money could be. It was clear that Maureen could have made it up to the mine to stash the loot, and if she had left it somewhere else, it would have been found by now. It had to be here. He continued walking, keeping his eyes focused on the ceiling as the wide beam flashlight illuminated the stone. His foot caught on a ridge on the mine floor, and he tumbled forward. He dropped the flashlight and lantern as his hands spread out to break his fall. Both of them shut off as they impacted the hard ground, and Dale couldn't keep his face from smashing against the dirty stone. It was pitch black. Dale lay still for a moment. He could feel something warm and wet dripping down over his mouth, and could smell the blood. He reached out, deliberately and systematically, searching for the flashlight or the lantern. He found the latter first, and fumbled for the switch. Nothing. He felt around to the bottom and discovered the battery compartment had opened up, and the batteries were now spread out in the darkness as well. He got to his knees and realized he had smashed the left one in the fall. Putting weight on it created an explosion of pain. He sat down instead, massaging the joint until he could flex it comfortably. Then he heard something in the dark, someone knocking. No, it was more of a pounding, as if there was a hammer being smashed into the wall in the distance. Ghosts? He asked himself. Had Marine asked the spirits of dead prospectors to scare him or maybe even harm him? Was she mad that he had left Danny alone in the dark? He was able to cover more ground on his own, and if the kid closed his eyes, it would be just like he was sleeping. The banging was constant, almost insistent, and the vibrations seemed to be coming from everywhere at once. Was it possible there was someone besides himself and Danny in the mine? Or trying to get into the mine? Someone trying to break through the cement, blocking the main entrance. Which way was that? He had lost all sense of direction at this point. If it was someone coming in, that meant they knew, or at least suspected, that they were here. Had Liam betrayed him? He had said he was going to steer the search away from the mine, but here they were. Dale started reaching around, continuing his search for the batteries or the flashlight. Once he had finished the area in his immediate vicinity, he shuffled forward and repeated the process. When he had gone what he guessed was about 10 feet, he gave up and turned around, starting to search in the other direction. Was he imagining it, or was the pounding getting louder? His hand bumped against something that rolled away from him in the dark. Dale leaned over, slapping his hand against the ground, trying to find what it was. His hand finally landed on the barrel of the small flashlight. He reached for the button on the back. Again, nothing happened. He felt up and down the length of the flashlight, but it seemed to be intact. He grabbed both ends and gave it a twist, checking to make sure it was securely fastened, and the bulb lit up. Dale sighed in relief. He used the flashlight to find the batteries for the lantern and restored it to working order. He slowly got to his feet and tested his weight on his injured knee. There was a little discomfort, but it wasn't broken. He could hear the pounding a little louder now, but still couldn't tell which direction it was coming from. Was it getting closer, or were his ears playing tricks on him? He picked a direction and moved steadily forward, still inspecting the ceiling, but taking care with his steps.
Chapter 58.
Jennifer found her way to the main tunnel of the mine through the small passage that connected it to the chamber she had crawled into. The light from her phone barely penetrated the darkness. There was no sign of Danny or his kidnapper. She wanted to call out to the boy, but was afraid of alerting his captor. Her best chance was to surprise them. What she would do after that was something she really hadn't thought about. She would probably start with a strong front kick to his groin, and then move on to some more conventional martial arts moves. Hopefully she would be able to disable him enough to escape with Danny. Then again, if there was more than one of them, or they had guns, she didn't want to think about that. She wasn't sure which way to go, so she chose a direction that led deeper into the mine. She kept her light low to the ground, trying to see if she could spot any sign of life in the distance. She heard something before she saw anything, a faint voice. "Hello?" it asked softly. "Danny, is that you?" "Yes," he answered. Jennifer hurried down the tunnel, then rounded a slight bend and saw Danny Foreman standing there, his left hand reaching out to the wall, clad only in his pajamas and slippers. His face and clothing were smeared with dirt, and he looked like he had been crying. She rushed up to him and grabbed him in a hug. He hugged her back. "Are you all right?" she asked. "Uh-huh," Danny said, nodding. "Marine's husband brought me." "Her husband?" "His name is Dale." Jennifer recalled the name from the conversation at the foreman's house. "Where is he now?" "He's looking for the money," Danny replied. "It's here?" she asked. Danny shook his head. "Marine just told him that so we could get away. She said somebody told her they were coming to help us." She didn't know who. Sam must have gotten through, Jennifer said. Do you know what direction Dale went?
No, it was dark. He left me at the end of the mine.
Jennifer shined her light down the tunnel, but couldn't see the end.
How did you get here? Maureen helped me.
Jennifer looked around, hoping the circumstances might make her more receptive to perceiving the ghost, but she saw nothing but the rough walls of the mine.
Okay, let's get you out of here and back home. Do you want me to carry you?
I can walk, Danny insisted.
Jennifer shined her light back down the way she had come from, looking and listening. She noticed something she hadn't heard before, a rhythmic pounding as if someone was hitting the rock with a big hammer. The officers breaking down the cement plug. If Dale heard it too, he might decide to make his way back out the way he came in. At least she knew there was only one kidnapper. She had to decide whether to try to make it back to where she had come in or head for the main entrance.
This way, Danny said, pointing in the direction they were going.
Jennifer looked at him. He peered back at her.
Maureen says if we go this way, we can get to the main entrance, while Dale goes the other way. She says the mine is kind of a big loop.
He said it so casually, so matter-of-factly, that she instantly believed him.
Okay, sounds good, she said.
Danny led the way.
Chapter 59.
The officers smashed away at the cement. It was thick, but hadn't been properly cured, so it was fairly crumbly and disintegrated with each strike of the sledgehammers and picks they were using. One of them stood back and set his hammer with the head resting on the ground and leaned against it for support while he took a short break. The other reared back with a pickaxe and struck the dent they had made in the cement. The steel spike pierced the plug, throwing the officer off balance. He pulled the tool back. There was a hole opening into the darkness of the mine. The officer who was taking a break grabbed his radio and broadcast a message.
We're through, Chief.
A second later, the chief replied.
All right, we're heading back. Did you let Rainey know?
Haven't heard from him, the officer replied.
Copy that,
the chief answered. The officer clipped the radio back to his belt and grabbed hold of the hammer. Now that they had an opening, they were able to make quick work of the cement as large chunks broke away with each blow. A short while later, there was light bouncing down the path, and Sam came jogging into view. The chief followed shortly thereafter.
Stay back, the chief warned Sam.
Sam stepped aside as the chief approached the breach in the cement plug and shined his light inside. He took a step back, shocked and surprised, when a face appeared in the opening. It was Dr. Day.
Jennifer,
Sam called out. Jennifer examined the hole they had made.
Can you give me a hand? She asked.
She disappeared back inside, and then two slipper-clad feet appeared in the opening. The officers rushed forward and pulled Danny out as Jennifer lifted him through the hole into the arms of the men. Then Jennifer crawled headfirst through the hole, and Sam stepped forward to help her.
Are you all right?
He asked. Jennifer wrapped her arms around Sam's neck and leaned on him while the officers helped extract her from the mine. Sam stepped back and her feet cleared the hole in the cement, and she slammed into him. He stood fast, holding her tight. Jennifer's feet found the ground, and she pulled back, offering a grateful smile to Sam. Then she turned her attention to Danny.
Tell Maureen thanks.
Danny rolled his eyes and sighed.
I don't have to tell her what you say. She can hear you.
Jennifer smiled. It was obviously not the first time he'd had to explain this to someone.
What happened to the kidnapper?
The chief asked.
He's trying to get out the other way, Danny explained.
It's Dale Everly, Jennifer said. Chief Lewis grunted.
Where's this secret entrance?
That way, Jennifer said, then with a note of concern. Nate is there by himself.
The chief nodded to one of the officers.
You stay here in case he doubles back this way,
then to Jennifer and Sam.
You two stay with the boy.
Nate was getting nervous. It had been over 15 minutes since Jennifer had disappeared into the crack in the rock, and his attempts to use the radio had continued to prove fruitless. Then he saw a light coming out of the tunnel, but instead of Jennifer's head poking through, it was a man's, with short-cropped salt-and-pepper hair. Nate turned off the light on his phone and watched the man struggle through the narrow opening. He managed to get one arm and then his head through, then he snaked the other arm out. The man grabbed onto some of the nearby branches in an effort to pull himself the rest of the way through, but he couldn't get his hips past the opening, and obviously he couldn't push his way out with his feet from the other side.
Damn it, he exclaimed. This is all I need.
Nate turned his light back on. He recognized the man instantly when he turned his face toward him. Dale Everly.
Evening, Dale. Need a hand? He asked.
Dale looked up at Nate, surprised and then confused.
"Who are you?"
he asked. Nate smiled. "The guy you need to assure you didn't hurt the kid or woman who went in after him."
"What woman?"
he asked.
"Are you talking about Maureen?"
So it was true. The guy believed Danny had a hotline to his dead wife.
"Dr. Day is just fine,"
Chief Lewis said from behind Nate. Nate spun around and saw the chief and one of his officers walking up to them.
"The kid's okay, too,"
he added as he shined his light on the ex-con stuck in the hole. The officer laughed.
"He looks like Winnie the Pooh."
The chief gave him an annoyed look.
"My kid loves that book, especially the part where they draw a face on his butt."
Nate and Chief Lewis ignored the officer.
"I guess we should pull him out,"
the chief suggested. Dale tried to push himself back inside. Nate grabbed one of his arms, stopping the attempt. The chief managed to get a grip on the other arm, and together they pulled. Dale screamed in pain as his back and his hips scraped against the sharp edges of the crack he was stuck in. They heaved and nearly fell over as Dale popped out like a reluctant cork. The officer rushed forward with a pair of handcuffs, and before Dale could manage to get his balance, his hands were linked behind his back.
"Dale Everly, you're under arrest for kidnapping, parole violations, and probably trespassing,"
the chief announced. They marched him back to the mine entrance, where Jennifer and Sam were sharing a candy bar with Danny.
"Hi, Dale,"
Danny said. The man grunted at the boy, obviously frustrated that his plan ended with him in handcuffs. Jennifer approached Dale, her face inches away from his.
"What kind of man kidnaps a boy from his home, drags him out to an abandoned mine, and leaves him alone in the dark? You should be ashamed. I hope you spend the rest of your life in prison."
"We'll see to that," Chief Lewis promised.
He eyed the hole made in the cement, plugging the entrance to the mine.
"I guess we better get some people up here to knock the rest of that out. Give the mine a good search."
"It's not in there,"
Dale insisted.
"She lied to me. I can't believe she lied to me."
"You threatened the boy," Sam answered. Everyone turned to him. For whatever reason Danny can see and hear her, they formed a bond, a friendship. She probably has maternal feelings toward him. Never come between a mother and a child, even if they're not related.
"Even if she's dead," Jennifer added.
"Let's get Danny back to his parents," Nate suggested, hoping to change the subject.
"And this guy into a cell," the chief added.
Chapter 60
Liam sat in the car, keeping an eye on the rental tucked away in the trees. No one had come by, and nothing had happened except for the sun setting and darkness descending. It seemed obvious at this point that Dale had failed to find the loot and likely would be caught. It would only be a matter of time before the ex-con turned on Liam. He had an exit plan and was tempted to just take off right now, but it was likely Dale would wait to give them Liam's name, hoping he could use it for leverage. Then he heard faint voices on the radio. He couldn't make out everything they said, something about breaking through. He tried to contact the chief or one of the other officers, but the mountain made that nearly impossible, and no one answered his queries as to what was going on. Eventually, he saw lights dancing in the distance, heading toward him along the path they had left on. When they broke out of the trees, he could see one of the officers escorting Dale, followed by the chief, the detective, and the parapsychologist and her psychic friend. He could see the man who claimed to be able to speak with Maureen carrying something. Then he realized it was the boy. Liam got out of the car, trying to make eye contact with Dale. Dale avoided his gaze. Once they reached the cars, Chief Lewis walked over to Dale and patted his pockets. He found what he was looking for, a set of car keys. He tossed them to one of the officers.
"You drive that rental back down to the station. Make sure you wear gloves."
He turned to the other officer.
"You ride with Detective Rainey and take the boy to the hospital. As soon as you have a cell signal, call his parents. Make sure they meet us there."
Then he turned to Liam.
"You and I are going to take him to the station."
Liam nodded his understanding. He opened the door to the police car and helped the other officer squeeze Dale into the back seat. Sam carried Danny to Nate's SUV. He and Jennifer got into the back with Danny, while the officer, Chief Lewis had assigned to accompany them, rode shotgun. Nate was the first one to turn his car around and head back down the fire road. The officer in the rental followed. Chief Lewis sat behind the wheel of the police car, watching the other vehicles disappear in his rearview mirror. Once they were well and gone, he turned around and looked at Dale. Then he turned and looked at Liam.
"So, which one of you fuck-ups wants to tell me what the hell you were thinking dragging that boy into that mine?"
Liam tried his best not to betray his surprise at the chief's accusation. Dale looked at the chief, studying his face, remembering. There was something about that voice.
"It's you," he said.
Liam looked at Dale, wondering what he was talking about. Dale seemed surprised that it wasn't obvious to Liam.
"Our silent partner, the mastermind."
Liam looked again at the chief. The man they had met with had worn dark glasses and a hat and spoke in a very deliberate fashion. But now that Dale mentioned it, it was clear that the man who had provided them with the plan and the means to rob that bank all those years ago, and Chief Lewis, were one and the same.
"You really think I'd take an SFPD pension and then put up with all the bullshit of this small-town police department for my health? I knew this knucklehead was getting out, and that you were still hanging around waiting for him. But I didn't think you would do something so monumentally stupid that I'd have to clean up after you. The money's in that mine, you better tell me now. Otherwise the crew I'm going to send in is going to find it, and we all get nothing." "It's not in there," I looked. "It's not that big, not that many places she could have stuffed a large duffel bag." "So the boy was making it up."
Dale shook his head.
"He knows things, things only Maureen would know. But apparently ghosts don't have photographic memories."
"Okay," the chief said calmly.
"Here's what's going to happen. Officer McDonald and I are going to take you to the station, and you'll be booked into custody. You will say nothing. You won't even ask for a lawyer. When the time is right, you'll get a chance to escape. Not if you understand."
Dale nodded. Then he addressed Liam.
"You stick with me. After we drop him off, we'll head to the hospital. If somehow this kid does know where the loot is, we need to move fast."
The chief didn't wait for a reply. He started the car, then backed up and swung back around onto the fire road.
Chapter 61.
Marcia and Greg rushed up to the emergency department receptionist. Liam was waiting there, and before they had a chance to ask about Danny, he stepped up to them.
"This way," he said, waving them toward a set of large double doors.
"Is he okay?"
Marcia asked.
"He's fine," Liam assured her.
He led them through the doors to an examination room. Danny was perched on the edge of the hospital bed while a doctor examined his eyes. Marcia rushed to him and grabbed him in a hug, ignoring the presence of the doctor.
"Are you all right?"
she asked, smothering to the point where he could barely answer her. The doctor replied instead.
"He's going to be fine. A little dehydrated, but no injuries aside from a few scrapes."
"He was very brave," Jennifer said.
Marcia responded to Jennifer's comment with a glare.
"He wouldn't be here if your people hadn't..."
"It's no one's fault," Nate insisted. Once Dale Everly got out of prison, it was inevitable he would have come snooping around the house where he used to live. "The important thing is that Danny is okay." Nate absently rubbed at his bad shoulder. He had tweaked it when he and Chief Lewis had yanked Dale Everly from the hidden mine entrance. He desperately wanted to take one of his pain pills, but he had left them in the car. Marcia appeared to settle down. She cast another look at Jennifer that was likely the closest thing to an apology she was going to get.
"Are you all right?" the doctor asked Nate, indicating his shoulder. "Did you hurt yourself?"
"No, it's an old injury. I just tweaked it."
He cast a glance at Jennifer's arm, where some abrasions were crusted with dried blood. "She might need some antibiotics, though." Sam reached out and held her arm as if it was a fragile vase.
"Does it hurt?"
he asked. Jennifer shook her head.
"No, it's fine."
Nate looked away from the couple, focusing instead on Danny. He noticed Officer McDonald standing just outside the door, listening attentively.
"Chief," Nate said, "I don't mean to step on your toes, but it probably would be a good idea to ask Danny a few questions about what happened while it's fresh. We don't know if Everly was working alone or not."
"Can't we do this later?"
Marcia asked. Chief Lewis exchanged a look with Nate. Nate assumed the chief wanted to balance the needs of his investigation with the well-being of the foreman boy, but he couldn't ignore the gut feeling he had that there was more to the story. Jennifer would probably accuse him of being clairvoyant, but he knew the kind of scrutiny an ex-con on parole is under. He would have needed someone to arrange the rental car, for one thing.
"Just a few questions," Chief Lewis said to Marcia. "I promise, it won't take long."
Marcia sat down on the bed next to Danny, putting a protective arm around him.
"Okay, just a few."
Greg moved to stand next to his wife and son in silent solidarity.
"What's the first thing you remember?"
Chief Lewis asked Danny. Danny took a moment, thinking back to the beginning of what was a very long day for him.
"I woke up in a big bed.
My eyes were covered, and there was tape on my mouth, and my hands and feet were tied with those plastic things. Dale wanted to know if I could really talk to Maureen, and he wanted her to tell him where she hid his treasure.
Nate smiled at the word Danny had used, treasure.
Was there anyone else?
There was a man who came by and asked Dale a bunch of questions. I couldn't hear him very well, though.
Nate noticed Liam leaning into the room, his eyes focused on Danny.
Did you see him?
The chief asked. Danny shook his head.
No, Dale didn't take off my blindfold until later.
Liam seemed to visibly relax.
But Maureen saw him,
Danny added. The chief didn't know what to make of that answer. He shot a glance at Nate, then Dr. Day, before returning his attention to Danny.
She did?
Uh-huh.
And does she know who it was?
Danny raised a hand and pointed across the room at the officer standing in the door.
Officer Liam, he said.
All eyes swung around to Liam, except Nate, who was watching Chief Lewis.
The old cop didn't seem at all shocked by the accusation, just as he wasn't surprised to see Dale stuck in the hole at the mine.
Liam became defensive.
When I saw Dale, he was at the halfway house, and there wasn't any kid in his room.
Everyone continued to stare at him.
You can't believe a kid who says some ghost saw me, he said, laughing off the allegation.
Sam lifted his chin, cocked his head as if he was listening to something.
Liar, Sam said. Maureen says you're lying.
He's the one who shot Maureen,
Danny added. Liam laughed.
Chief, seriously?
Chief Lewis didn't answer. He stared a warning at Liam. Liam's expression shifted from mild amusement to fear. He took a step back, then bolted down the hall. Nate instinctively made a move to chase him, but was all the way on the other side of the room. Sam reached the door before he did and started chasing after the officer. Nate followed in a close second. Liam didn't stand a chance against Sam. The psychic was extremely fit and obviously no stranger to cardio. It didn't take him long to chase down the frightened officer. Nate slowed his pace when he saw Sam reach out and grab Liam's arm. The officer spun around, lost his balance, and smacked his head into a concrete block wall. Nate could hear the sickening crack the man's head made. Liam collapsed into a heap. He was unconscious for a moment, but then opened his eyes, obviously disoriented. Nate approached them and disarmed the officer, then grabbed the man's handcuffs from the small holster at his back and clamped his wrists together. A crowd of hospital employees gathered. Blood streamed out of a cut hidden somewhere behind his hairline. A nurse approached and inspected the wound with a gloved hand.
What happened here? She asked.
He fell, Nate replied simply.
By then, Chief Lewis and Jennifer had caught up as well. Two more officers arrived, likely summoned by the chief.
Take him back to the station, he ordered.
He should be looked at. He might have a concussion, the nurse insisted.
The chief considered, then nodded his okay. The officers lifted Liam to his feet and followed the nurse to a nearby examination room.
Make sure you read him his rights, the chief added. He talks to no one until I have a chance to interrogate him. You understand?
The officers nodded. Lewis turned to Nate.
Thanks for catching him.
Don't thank me. Sam's the one who chased him down. I just slapped his own cuffs on.
Maureen watched as Liam was escorted away. She was relieved that both of the men who had threatened Danny were now in the hands of the police, but also sad that one of them was Dale.
But what had really shaken her was the memory that had come into her when Liam had smugly dismissed Danny's charge. It was the day of the robbery. She had returned to the house to get some of her things and some cash so she could get away. And then Liam had shown up. To warn her, he had said. She made her way up to the attic where she stashed the photos and left a note for Dale, then climbed out onto the branch of the old oak. If she could make it to the woods, she could get away.
Liam would stall them, redirect their attention to someplace else. Maureen could hear other cars and officers arriving as she crawled through the boughs of the giant tree. She looked back to make sure no one was watching. But there was someone coming around the front corner of the house. She was relieved to see it was Liam. He smiled up at her, the same sly grin he had made when Danny accused him of being in the motel room with Dale. Then he lifted his gun, aimed, and fired. It was Liam who had killed her. He had ended her life, and with it, all her dreams. She looked over at Danny, safe in the embrace of his parents, and recalled another memory. Before they had ever thought of robbing the Danville Bank, shortly after they had been married, Maureen and Dale had been walking in the woods behind the house. She had just shown him the mine where she had played as a child,
and took him down into a valley where there was an old dry well she had discovered when she was a kid. It wasn't as interesting to her friends as the mine was, but she believed it was magic. A wishing well. And it was there, with her hand grasping Dale's, that she wished with all her heart that she and Dale would have a family filled with children. Maybe a little boy, like Danny.
I know where the treasure is, she said to Danny.
Danny looked up at her, his eyes lighting up with excitement.
You do?
Do what, honey? Marcia asked him.
Maureen says she remembers where she put the treasure.
Jennifer, Sam, and Nate appeared in the doorway, catching his last statement.
She does?
Jennifer asked, curious.
She does, Sam confirmed.
Well, don't keep us in suspense, Nate said, the note of sarcasm clear in his voice.
It's in the wishing well, he said.
Maureen smiled. Her wish had come true.
Thank you for listening to Afterlife, a Rainy Day Investigation, on the Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs fiction podcast. Remember to subscribe, share, rate, and review not only this podcast, but the novel you are currently listening to. The links to Amazon, Audible, and Goodreads are in the description for this episode. You can sign up for the Insomniacs Snooze Letter at bedtimestories.studio and get a free bookmark. And if you want to know more about the Rainy Day Investigations Paranormal Mystery Book Series, visit rainyandday.com. That's RAINEYANDAYE.com. You can find out more about the host of Bedtime Stories for Insomniacs at richhosick.com. Thanks again, and all the very best.